Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 22nd of February, Anno Domini 2013, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. It's time for the news. I can't, There we go. Oh, I see what happened. All right. Here we go. The news. OpenSignal released a report on Thursday looking at the state of LTE coverage and speeds around the world, revealing that contrary to what you might expect, not all LTE networks perform comparably. While 4G is a convenient term for consumers to get their heads around, the performance of networks being rolled out in different countries is wildly variable, with some operators actually showing overall declines in 4G download speeds in the last year. For example, the data covering the second half of 2013 shows that in the U.S., 4G download speeds have dropped from an average of 9.6 megabits per second in the second half of 2012 to 6.5 megabits for 2013, a decline of more than 30%. No particular operator seems to be at fault for dragging the average down either. The report notes that the U.S. Networks uniformly perform poorly for speed, with Metro PCS recording the slowest speeds of all eligible networks. The U.S. wasn't actually the slowest country overall. The Philippines took that spot with an average speed of 5.3 megabits per second. It's not just spectrum allocations that have an effect on speeds, though. Staggered network rollouts, equipment upgrades, and the resulting additional customers all can come together to contribute to a more congested service. At the top of the country list was Australia, which had improved its average download speed by 42%, going from 17.3 megabits per second to 24.5 megabits per second. So the good thing about Australia, everything there will try to kill you, but you can call for help really fast. Overall, the U.S. didn't fare well on speed, but it manages to keep its connection to LTE services for 67% of the time, which somewhat redresses the poor downloads. The fastest country by download speed, which was Australia, does a little less well in coverage, managing only 58%. There are a lot of data in the report, and some of them may be contrary to expectations, but overall, it shows a picture of networks still in the flux of rollouts and looking for ways to manage large numbers of new users without having a knock-on effect on its existing customers. And from the data, it seems some operators are doing better than others at this. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis, would like us to remind you, the U.S. has the second slowest 4G in the world. The choices are, I knew it, at least we're not the Philippines, I can wait, and who cares, it just means we hit the data cap faster. And so far we have 26 votes, and I knew it is the number one. But I know you'll have more to say, so check the forums out. If you head down the right-hand column under Fascinating Stuff, the top choice is the forums. And if you look for the forum title 22 Feb 14, the U.S. has the second slowest 4G in the world, you can join in the discussion. And you can also give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
And who would have figured that coverage in Australia would have been bad? I mean,
no, it's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, for
it's the best in the world. It's the fastest in the world.
No, as far as the coverage overall.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there's so much in the middle that of the country. Been, yeah. Right.
No mountains to block signals, yeah. Right. So we can understand that why America is slow in landline speeds, because we have so much old copper bouncing around. But why are we slow in wireless speeds? We should be leading the world in wireless
speeds. Well, I believe, if I read this correctly, it's aggregate speed.
Ah.
So you here on the East Coast, we may have pretty decent speeds, but over on the West Coast, or rather in the middle of the country, that vast heartland, corn belt, blah, 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 where you can go miles with zero signal at all, and of course in mountains.
Yeah.
And zero neighbors,
right. So I think that's the deal right there.
Yeah, it's the same thing. If you have large areas of land of almost zero population, there's not likely to be a lot of cell towers there.
Right. Exactly right.
I mean, why cover an area where there's nobody around?
Well, some of the carriers, the telephone and especially internet carriers have been trying to stop running landlines and do everything wireless because it's cheaper and easier to put a tower up than it is to run wire everywhere.
Right.
Even we've always said that wireless is convenient, but wired is better for many reasons.
Right. And of course there's the Loon project from Google where they're lofting balloons with Wi-Fi routers on them.
99 lift balloon?
Where they're sending up balloons with Wi-Fi routers on them.
No, sir, that wasn't a UFO. That was just a Google weather balloon.
Yep. I think they're actually starting that in Australia, which doesn't need it, apparently. Oh, no, we had better coverage than Australia, so they need it in the outback there. The problem is there are people who live out there, and many of them, and the same in our corn belt and mountains and everywhere else. And often those are the places, mountainous areas, etc., where you most need a connection when you have an emergency, and they just aren't there. So my hope is that the Loon project turns out to be a success, and that Google starts throwing those things up everywhere. That should be kind of that would be kind of fun actually to think. It's not, you know, you already, if you think about it, there's something awe-inspiring about the fact that you make a phone call and it goes to a satellite thousands and thousands, 22,000 miles above the Earth and bounces back. And that's how you communicate with people nowadays. But the thought of doing the same with a, not quite as high, of course, but with a wireless connection is kind of fun. I actually like the idea.
We take it all for granted so much that, you know, you pick up the phone and the person at the other end rings. We don't even have commercials about you can hear a pin drop anymore. That's taken for granted.
Right.
It should be perfect clarity.
Right, it should be. It isn't often, but it certainly should be.
My only thing with the balloon idea is, how is Google going to be able to maintain those once they're launched?
They're Google.
Well, it makes me think of the makes me think of the World War II barrage balloons.
Exactly.
I've been watching Fleming, The Man Who Would Be Bond, and it takes place during World War II, and the balloons everywhere. I keep waiting for Jack Harkness to come out of one of them.
Yeah.
I'm mixing my genres again.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no. Well, but you're at least not mixing your network.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a those balloons are known to work. I mean, we've had them since World War II and known to work. The question really becomes, how about storms and, you know, that stuff? That's the real issue. We know the balloons work. The question is, how durable are they?
Yeah, that would be.
Yeah, what's the attrition rate?
Right, LOON, loon.
Is that why I can't find it?
Yeah.
Although I did find
short for balloon.
Yeah. So I keep thinking of the Canadian loony.
Right.
The Google Moon, like they have Google Earth. Well, like there's Google Moon too.
Right.
With all of the photographs and projects put together.
Right, and of course there's they're doing indoors now. They're doing campuses. They did RIT. I don't know if it's up yet, but I know they did it, and a couple of others. So that's pretty cool. There's a lot of that really interesting stuff going on in order to map the world. In fact, we have a story later on about mapping the world. So I think we do. Did I put that in here as a... Yes, I did. We'll get to that a little later. Maybe. And it's pretty cool, the ability to map the physical world onto computers. I mean, we can have, you know, it started many years ago. Microsoft had whatever they called it that it had satellite images. And now Google does that as well. But the ability to actually physically map a location so that I could go in and say, you know, you are here. And you want to go there and take this elevator, go down this hall, turn left here.
Yeah, the walking directions have been added to Google Maps and Siri Maps and a lot of the mapping programs now, too.
Right.
Because we have this detailed indoor mapping.
Right. Put your destination in as Mordor, select walking, and hit enter. It's very cool. But yeah, the speeds are getting better in some cases. But like I said,
apparently Mordor is in Minneapolis.
Pick walking directions.
And yeah. Walking.
We're map searching here.
It's thinking.
Yeah, it's thinking.
Yeah.
But in terms of that, it doesn't much matter how fast our speeds are. This is wireless speed, however. Right now we don't have a lot of caps. For that, but for 4G cell speeds, we do. And if you're going to use your data on your 4G connection, in almost every case, you are going to be hit by a data cap. And so I don't care. You know, there was a story about a guy who had a technique. He says he has a technique for making cell data 1,000 times faster. My response to that was, big deal. Now I hit my cap in 0.00001 seconds. So what? You know, we continue to have that dichotomy between what we see on the commercials and what everybody would like us to do, which is to use our cell phones for everything. But on the other side, there's the fact that you hit your cap and you're done, or you're paying a lot more. Now, that's not really a dichotomy for the carriers. They want us to hit our cap and pay more. I get that.
And caps are arbitrary and aren't really a problem in the delivery of internet. It doesn't cost them more to deliver more.
Right.
It costs them to run the wires.
Well, in fact, the dirty little secret is everything is data nowadays. When you send an SMS, that's actually going as data. When you send, when you talk to someone on the phone, that's actually going as data. Now, there's no separation between data and voice and SMS. So they're just arbitrarily picking one of the three to say, well, you're paying more for this. A same thing that all the rest of the stuff is.
Well, because we're used to buying minutes, and we've all gotten used to buying minutes on our cell phone plan, but we're not using minutes anymore. We're using internet data, so they got to get us paying for that too.
Right,
and that's actually the biggest fear with the Comcast Time Warner merger, is that Comcast has data caps in virtually every city that they have. So if they become the provider here in Rochester, are they going to institute their caps?
I'm sure.
They're going to try, at least.
I'm sure. It's how they make
money. Well, Time Warner tries, too. That doesn't mean they've actually succeeded in doing it. That means they've tried to do it.
Yep, that's where Phil Dampier and Stop the Cap mobilizes his army, and they get people to protest. Although, there was an interesting thing about Chuck Schumer, our local senator. He initially came out in praise of the Comcast merger because he said it would keep jobs in New York. I'm not quite sure how.
Yeah, right.
But then he had to recuse himself because his brother is an attorney who was deeply involved in the deal.
Yeah.
So they don't, you know, they don't want to have the appearance of impropriety.
Yeah.
Yeah, the appearance.
Yeah, of impropriety. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have to be honest. I've never been a huge fan of politicians to begin with. There are some I know personally who are very, very nice human beings. But as a class, they are scum. And I can't be, I just can't be a fan.
Comcast's big big defense for this merger was that, well, we have a non-compete clause with Time Warner anyways, so it's not going to really affect anything. Because they're in markets that we're not in, and we're in markets that they're not in, and we can't cross anyway, so it's not going to really hurt competition because we're already not in each other's markets.
And their non-compete clause creates a monopoly.
Right.
Because there's no competition, that's the definition of a monopoly, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that's a natural monopoly.
Yeah.
Right? There's a difference between a monopoly and a natural monopoly. It's always been considered that someplace like the phone company, the electric company, the gas company, those are natural monopolies because other people aren't going to spend the time and the money to come in and build the infrastructure.
Yeah.
So they were thought of as natural monopolies. That is a nonsense term.
Yeah, of course it is.
That means the rest of them are unnatural.
And right. And, well, yeah, so they are, yeah, actually. And the other, but now, particularly with broadband, there is so much money to be made, there is so much good competition out there in the marketplace, that having a natural monopoly on broadband, I'm not even talking about cable television now, I'm talking about broadband. Having a natural monopoly on broadband is silly. It's not the sort of thing that actually makes any sense whatsoever. All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We will be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. See you in a couple of minutes. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24:25 now, minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we were talking about network speeds before the break, but I think we have somebody coming up on the phone. So we'll just, why don't you just tell us who it is, Michael?
Off the message boards on the phone, here is Annoyed from Henrietta.
Annoyed. Hello, Annoyed. How are you?
Good afternoon, Nick. I'm just calling because you guys have been promoting Foxit as an alternative for Adobe's PDF reader for a long time, so a lot of your listeners are probably trying to use it.
Yep.
I was rebuilding machine this weekend, downloading fresh off their site. Guess who's they're pairing with their? Oh. Guess who they're pairing advertising and marketing with?
Who?
Conduit/Search Protect.
No, no, no.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Now we have to find something else.
Yeah, in the forum where you had posted that, Smiley B gave a link to one called PDF Exchange.
Yeah, I posted a warning in there too.
Yep.
I just want everybody to know that's now a dead product.
Yeah, I guess it is. All right.
And we've talked about that in the past. So many of the free programs have had to partner with some advertising company to make their money that it's getting to be more obtrusive now.
Yeah, yep. But Conduit and Search Protect is a little bit more than an advertising company.
Yeah, they're really bad.
Yeah. All right.
Well, I just thought I'd let you know.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, basically what he's saying is that when you download it, you also get some other stuff along with it. It's not really viruses or malware of that sort.
It's crapware.
But it's crapware. It's annoying, obtrusive, horrifying stuff. You can uninstall it, but I think you can't not install it if you're going to install Foxit.
They've crossed to the dark side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and as Steve said, you know, the reality is people got to make money, and that's one of the ways that they do it. They get involved with those companies because those companies will pay to piggyback onto them.
Apparently, when you try to uninstall Conduit, it deletes the NT loader from Windows.
Nice.
Which is the core of Windows, and it cannot run without it.
Right. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's evil. Well, what it probably does is replace it on install.
Yeah, replaces it with its own, and then you uninstall Conduit and doesn't put the Windows one back.
Oh, that's nasty and evil. Okay, no more Foxit. I guess we're going to have to change that about it. I don't know what else to say.
Well, and related to Adobe News, there was another zero-day emergency Flash update this week. Flash and PDF are two of the big targets, and they get their apps get updated so often that people are annoyed by it and sick of it and just click OK, OK, OK. And then the bad guys have become aware of that and will put out fake updates that claim to be from Adobe, and people just click OK because they're used to it. And it's very frustrating. You have to read those messages carefully, read all of the lines to see where it's actually coming from, and make sure it's spelled right. You know, adobe.com, not adobo or what was the other one?
Ado.be.
Yeah. So.
You have to be very careful. And it's just due diligence on your part. If you're not sure, don't install it.
Just uninstall Flash, uninstall the Adobe Reader. At least on the Apple side, Apple makes their own PDF reader that comes with the Mac, so you don't necessarily have to have the Adobe Reader.
Right. Linux has Chrome is the same way. It has its own built-in PDF reader.
Yeah.
So if you use Chrome, you don't have to worry either. But if it's going to be Flash, I set Flash to always ask me before you run. That way I don't always get those drive-by video things running. Sometimes I still do.
Yep.
But I love the new Chrome. In the tabs, if music is playing, there's a little speaker icon. If that site has turned on your camera, there's a little recording, little red dot recording icon. And there's a third one. I forget what the third one is. Video, audio, I don't know.
Chat.
Smell-o-vision. No, I don't remember. Something that could conceivably be either annoying or obtrusive. But I forget what the third one is, but there's a third one as well. So I really like that. That's kind of a nice thing. These guys over at Conduit and Search Protect are not good people. Particularly if they prevent you from actually uninstalling them by, you know, it's like four-year-olds. You tell them they can't do something, so they smash it. Well, that's what they're doing with your Windows system. And I'm just waiting for the day somebody sues them. In the meantime, let's go back to the news. Facebook announced on Wednesday that it had reached an agreement to buy popular mobile messaging startup WhatsApp for an upfront total of $16 billion, including $4 billion in cash and about $12 billion in Facebook shares. Co-founder and CEO Jan Koum will join Facebook's board of directors, but WhatsApp will continue to operate independently within Facebook, much like Instagram. The purchase price rises to as much as $19 billion once you factor in an additional $3 billion in restricted stock units that will be granted to WhatsApp's founders and employees, vesting over the next 4 years. $19 billion, billion with a B. The purchase price is insanely high for a startup with only 55 employees and many multiples of Facebook's reported $3 billion bid for Snapchat last year. The $19 billion valuation means Facebook believes WhatsApp is worth over $42 per user. Major companies that have market caps under $19 billion include United Continental, American Airlines, Ralph Lauren, Marriott International, Campbell Soup, Coach, and Tyson Foods. However, among Silicon Valley internet startups, it is notable that WhatsApp is actually profitable, but not through the normal monetizing avenues. WhatsApp doesn't show ads, and unlike other large messaging services, it hasn't built out a platform on which users can play games or purchase digital goods. Instead, it charges a $1 annual subscription after one free year. The acquisition also shoots Coom and his fellow WhatsApp co-founder Brian Acton into the billionaire ranks. Forbes estimates that Coom held about a 45% stake in the company, while Acton's stake was over 20%. I'll let you do the math on $19 billion. In event the merger fails to obtain regulatory approval, Facebook has agreed to pay a breakup fee. A breakup fee to WhatsApp of $1 billion in cash and issued to WhatsApp shares of Facebook Class A common stock equal to another $1 billion. So even if it doesn't go through, WhatsApp gets $2 billion.
So let me get this straight. Somebody, a subscriber who pays a $1 fee to the site is worth $42 to Facebook.
Somehow.
How? How is somebody who only pays $1 into the site worth $42 to Facebook?
Yeah, and for those of you who don't or aren't quick at math, WhatsApp has over 450 million monthly users, 70% of whom are active on a given day. They're adding more than 1 million new registered users per day. $1 million a day. $1 million a day. As part of the deal, its headquarters will remain in Mountain View, California, and WhatsApp's team will not mix with those working on Facebook's existing Messenger app. So do you use WhatsApp? Is it worth a buck a year? Is it worth $19 billion? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
And WhatsApp was actually the target of a phishing attack last month. I was getting three or four messages a day. You have a voicemail waiting in WhatsApp. Click here. I don't have a WhatsApp account. And
yeah, right.
It's apparently very big in Asia.
Yes. Yeah, not quite so much in the United States, but that's part of it.
Yeah.
In terms of Facebook's penetration, the areas where WhatsApp is really big are not necessarily the areas where Facebook is really big.
Yeah.
And so that gives them an edge. And of course, shortly, I'm sure we'll be seeing every WhatsApp message posted to people's Facebook walls. That's going to cut down a lot on the WhatsApp usage.
Yep.
Trust me on this one.
There's an interesting diagram in one of the articles that in 2009, Facebook bought Friendfeed for $1 million. $47 million, and they had 1 million users. So that's $47 per user. In 2012, they bought Instagram for $1 billion, and that was $33 per user. And now they bought WhatsApp for $19 billion, or $42 per user. So they're paying that $30, $40 per user fee is apparently their norm.
Well, you know what? If somebody wanted to buy my little startup for $19 billion, I don't know that I could sign the papers fast enough.
Yeah, I
have
me
to,
too. Yeah.
I agree with that.
Well, you know that website you only charge $1 a subscriber fee for? I'm going to pay you.
Yeah, exactly.
Take it. Take
exactly.
It. Take it. Leave the money at the door and take
on
it.
On the other hand, they are getting $1 million a day next year, but even so, wow, $19 billion. Yeah,
Wonder what Facebook is planning on doing with it, because if they're paying that much for it, they must be planning something. I mean, they're not just going to leave it as it is. It sounds like they're going to do something with it.
And apparently Google offered them $10 billion, and they turned down $10 billion
because Facebook was offering 19. Well, I get that.
Well, this was before Facebook put their offer in.
Well, they know what they were worth, but they got it.
It didn't include a seat on the board. Facebook is also giving them a seat on the Facebook board.
So you see, that's a big noise. I would just sit here. Okay, you give me $19 billion. I'm going to buy an island somewhere. I don't care if I never sit on anybody's anything anymore. I'm just happy to sit on my island in the sand in the beach and relax. I'll take that $19 billion, and you will never hear from me again. Thank you. Bye bye.
Yep.
I don't have an issue with that at all.
I will sit on my island and I will count my money.
That's right.
I heard.
I will hire someone to count my money.
I heard someone refer to that as the FU money.
That's yeah.
How much
exactly
money would it take
is.
To say and leave?
You know what it is? What FU money actually is? If you can live comfortably, not well, not you know super well, but comfortably, on the interest,
Yeah.
If you can do that, you know, and then if you want to buy something really wild, you dip into the interest. That's FU money. That's what that is. That's right there. And it's surprisingly less than you might think, depending on your lifestyle. But yeah, $19 billion. And WhatsApp is just a messaging app of which there are zillions. What really makes it worth that much money is as I said in the news story, they're one of the very, 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 very few apps that actually has a revenue stream. Everybody yeah. else is either we're selling ads or we're connected to something or we're downloading adware or we're doing whatever we're doing. Case in point being what you call it. But the reality is that if you can actually stand there and say, this app makes money on its own and that money is $1 million a day, you're worth $19 billion to somebody. Because people are going to stay with that app for a long time. And then when you connect it to Facebook, that's where really Facebook will make their money.
And that tends to be a very common topic in the blogs, is how long can Facebook stay relevant? Because already we're hearing that the kids have left Facebook because their parents are on it. So you know, It was Friendster and then FriendFeed and then MySpace and then Facebook. Whatever the hot new thing is, the kids these days, I feel old, the kids these days are all on Instagram.
Yep.
My son doesn't want a Facebook account because I'm
his parents
are on it. Yeah.
Exactly.
And I don't do anything with Facebook much.
Today,
anyway.
I ate a sandwich. Here's a picture of the sandwich.
Oh, the foodies are everywhere on Facebook. You might as well just call it Foodbook because that's all I see in my feeds anymore. I just had a sandwich. I don't really care that you just had a sandwich. I'm not interested in
it. Are you
going to
give me some of it?
Right.
Mama always told me don't talk about it unless you're going to share it.
That's right. So I don't know. I'm on Facebook too, but I pay attention. Let me put it this way. I pay attention to about 8 people, most of whom are extended family out there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm up to like 20 friends on Facebook and I'm very selective. And out of those 20 friends I have on Facebook, I may pay attention to like 5 of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you get the people who say, well, I've got 15,000 friends on Facebook. Well, no, you don't. You have 15,000 people who reached out and made some sort of connection on Facebook. That doesn't actually make them your friends. They're not necessarily people you'd sit around drinking beer with. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, Mina Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
As a business...
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we have Sherry on the line from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Sherry. What's up?
I wonder if you could answer a question about my internet connection on my Blu-ray player.
Sure.
Okay. I have a Samsung Blu-ray player, and it seems to be stuck in updating, downloading mode when connected to the internet. I was just wondering, you know, what that could be. The firmware is up to date. I've reset it several times, and every time I start it back up, it's stuck on updating and downloading.
Well, two things. When you say it's stuck there, how long have you waited?
Like a day.
Okay. All right, then.
Yeah, it's stuck there.
Yeah, it's stuck there. What it sounds like is that a bad download, uh-huh. is causing that. And I don't have an answer off the top of my head. Your best bet, how old is this player?
It's about 2009.
Yeah, okay. Your best bet is to get the serial number, go to Samsung's website and take a look at their support forum. Not the serial number, the model number.
Right. I've kind of done that, and everybody had the same complaint, but there were no answers. You know, they just said, you know, reset your system and all that. I've done that several times, and it's still stuck. Yeah.
Then that's just Samsung probably not caring, more or less.
Yeah. And a 2009 model, they probably replaced it in 2010 and don't care anymore.
Right.
Right. And sadly, without that kind of backup support from the manufacturer, there's almost nothing folks like us can do. And I mean, you and I, the people out on the streets, can do to change anything, unless you can actually get into the machine and make some changes to chips. There's nothing much you'll be able to do.
Sometimes it looks like some of the Samsung players have a USB firmware update option. So you on your computer, you download the update file, put it on the USB stick. Plug that into the Blu-ray player and let it update.
Well, it's already got the latest update. The last one was in 2013, and it has that. So I've done that already. After resetting the factory default,
right,
and then going and put the firmware and firmware update in again, and it still asks.
So you reset it to factory,
right?
You turn it on and install that USB update. Then you connect it to the internet, and it asks you to update again?
No, it accepts the update, but it's still stuck in the updating, downloading mode.
Oh, I see. Okay. If you can find it on the internet, look for the... Well, it probably automates, doesn't it? I was going to say look for the previous update. Install that one.
Oh, okay.
If you can find that one, install it, and either don't update anymore, or if it auto-updates, see what happens.
Oh, that's a good idea.
That's the only thing I can think of, Sherry. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Does it still play movies?
Yeah, I can play movies. I just can't connect to any apps, you know, on the internet.
Right, Netflix or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I also have Samsung Blu-ray player, and I love the connection to everything else.
Is there a network test option to make sure that the device can see the internet at all?
Yeah, I went into that. It can see it, and, you know, the connection's good. It's just the updating. There's a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if other people are having it too, then clearly the problem is with the update itself. So if you can find the previous update,
okay,
try that. It's really all I can suggest. You know, go through the whole thing.
Right.
Reset, blah, 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 blah.
Okay, it's a good idea.
Good luck, Sherry. Let us know.
All right.
Not that we have any other ideas.
Yeah. Well, that was helpful. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah.
All right, let us know.
And maybe start taking a look at some of the new models.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've seen that too. Maybe it won't be Samsung, though.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, okay.
All right, thank you, Sherry.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good luck. Yeah. I have the same. I've seen that too often. You know, a model gets old enough, and they don't care anymore. Here's actually my favorite story of the week. Slick Login, which is actually all one word, Slick Login. The sound-based password alternative has been acquired by Google just 5 months after launching at TechCrunch Disrupt. Word of the acquisition is confirmed by a notice on the company's site, where they say that they'll be joining Google in their efforts to make the internet safer. Everything is very heavily encrypted, so man-in-the-middle attacks are out. You can't record the audio and just play it back later, but hold on. Let me back up and tell you a little bit more about the thing itself. The idea behind Slick Login is very novel. To verify a user's identity and log them in, a website plays a uniquely generated, nearly silent sound through your computer's speakers. An app running on your phone picks up the sound, analyzes it, sends the signal back to the site server, confirming that you are who you say you are, or at least somebody who has that person's phone, and then you get logged in. So you go to whatever slick login site you'd like to log into, tap the login button, hold your phone up close, and you're in. This is very much like what Google now does with their two-factor authentication, where you log in and it sends a code to your phone. This just means you don't have to type that code in. It's the same basic idea. Interestingly, Slick Login can use a bunch of protocols to verify your phone's position, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, near-field communication, visual markers like QR codes, of course, GPS. Their self-dubbed secret sauce, though, is their use of uniquely generated sounds intentionally made inaudible to the human ear. Your computer plays the sound through its speakers. The app on your smartphone uses the device. So the question is, back to what I was saying earlier, everything is very heavily encrypted, so man-in-the-middle attacks are unlikely, if not completely out. You can't record the audio signal, just play it later, as that audio is uniquely tied to that moment. The next person would get a different audio signal. You can't just hold your phone up to someone else's audio signal in the hopes of getting logged into their account, because your phone wouldn't have the same login credentials stored on it or any of that stuff.
You'd have to be in the same...
Somebody's calling the... The thing I've got to...
My volume is muted.
So is mine, so I'm not sure what that's about.
It's not mine, because my phone's not even on, so... That's the only electronic I have on me, so...
Mine's down all the way, so I don't know who was calling who there.
My phone has no service. The crazy thing, we're at a radio station, but we happen to be inside a Faraday cage, so I can't get a radio signal.
We're in a tomb.
I can't get one in. Apparently, we can get them out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We're in this, like, tomb-type thing. So, yeah. Nobody gets a cell phone signal in here, I don't think, other than, like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's not, might be me, but I don't think it is. Oh, well, it doesn't matter.
So, yeah, so if you happen to be, did you have the website of that page open? Maybe it was playing a sound.
Maybe.
But, so if you happen to be in the same room as someone and it plays their sound, you might be able to intercept it and log in at that same instant.
Except you then have to have the same credentials on your phone that they have on their phone. Because one of the things you do when you sign up is you put a set of credentials on your phone that's linked to your login.
Yep.
So I've got my credentials. You've got your credentials. At the absolute worst, you'd log yourself in.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. The basic idea being that it's very much like it's a two-factor authentication, something you know, your password, and something you have, your phone, and the thought that somebody would have both of those things, your password and your phone, that's a difficult thing to have. So it's a very clever idea. I don't necessarily know that it's better or worse than something like codes for authentication, but what it is it's a little less user intensive and therefore less prone to users type. It's only a 4-digit code, but even so, you're less likely to type it wrong, because all you do is hold your phone, you know, you start the app, you log in, you hold your phone up to your speaker, and the next thing you know, you're in. It's done. Right.
And it's a lot easier than trying to read a CAPTCHA and understand what they meant.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think it'll be a while before we see this integrated into anything, because I'm sure they've kind of stopped doing whatever they were doing while they integrate with Google. But at some point, we'll see that come out as an interesting alternative to two-factor authentication. Very clever idea, actually.
It's a nice name, too. It's a pretty slick login.
Yeah. very clever. I'm a big fan of multi-factor authentication, at least two-factor. By the time you get into 3 and 4-factor, it gets kind of silly. But I'm a big fan of that because nowadays, the reality is that we're all just human, and so many of us use the same password for everything, or use a password that's easy to guess, or, you know, it's our favorite team or whatever. It's a common password, whether it's easy to guess or not. And so that leaves us vulnerable in a lot of ways. And because we use the same password on multiple sites, if they get one, the chances are good they've got multiple of them. And so if they get your Facebook password, they've got your banking password. At the very least, your banking password should be separate from everything else. But the reality is people can ruin your reputation as easily as they can ruin your bank account. So you should keep all of them fairly complex. That's why there are things like LastPass and KeyPass and stuff like that to make that to let you use very powerful passwords that are very difficult to guess. But having something like two-factor authentication, when I go to a new machine and log in, let's say I'm giving a talk and I log into Google, it comes and says, okay, type in the code. I now type in the code. There's a checkbox that says, don't ask on this machine again. Leave that unchecked. Even if the people are capturing my credentials so that like Firefox remembers my username and password, it won't work next time because it'll ask for the code again. And the code is, they don't get the code. I get the code. In fact, that's happened once or twice. I get a notice from Google that says your code is blah, 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 blah. And I'll just laugh. I'll still go change my password, but I'll laugh because there's no way that they can type that code in and get into the site. The same thing would be true of Slick Login. If they don't have your phone, they can't make that secondary connection to get into the website. Yeah. So it's a nice thing.
And some websites are kind of faking the second authentication. Your password is something you know. So the second authentication should be something different. You know, with the phone, it's something you have. Some websites will do multiple questions. So something you know and something else you know. Well, that doesn't really make a second factor. That's just something else the bad guys will get.
Right. And CAPTCHA doesn't solve that issue either. It solves the issue of are you human for some more complex CAPTCHAs.
For various definitions of human.
Right, exactly. Are you a human being? But it doesn't really stop people from stealing your password and using it. The only thing that does is that true two-factor authentication. Something you know, something you have, something you know, yeah. Something you see, maybe? I don't know.
And from the common password list, the most common password is 123456. So a lot of websites need you to have 8 characters.
You have to be an idiot to put that password on your luggage.
On my luggage, yeah. So the number 3 password is 123456789.
What's the number 2 password? You already know it.
Password. Yeah.
Yep.
So then someone had the idea of doing 123456789. That's number 6.
Woo!
and strangely, Adobe 123 is number 10 on the password list.
Nice.
That must be from those 100 million passwords that leaked out of Adobe.
Yep.
So it may not be your bank getting hacked. Adobe got hacked, and if it's the same password you use on your bank, you're in trouble.
Yep, that's exactly right. All right, listen, we're going to take a slightly longer break. You've wasted an entire hour of your life with us. I don't know why you would bother, but you did, and we're going to do it all again on the other side of this hour, but we're going to take a short break back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You can join in the fun by giving us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Of course, you can call us toll-free from anywhere in the known universe at 1-800-790-0415. You continue to listen to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, and we are right here on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1. Stay tuned. A whole nother hour of this nonsense is coming up right after this.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And in 4 minutes after the hour, we are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe. Apparently, I'm choking to death. Soundbites. You can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Google Fiber is ready to expand as Google has identified 9 metro areas.
Not us.
Yeah. Yeah, scattered around the country as possible sites of deployment. We've invited 34 cities in 9 metro areas across the U.S. to work with us to explore what it would take to build a new fiber optic network in their community, Google said in an announcement on Wednesday. Many of these cities asked for Google Fiber in 2010 and have since continued to try to bring better internet access to their residents. Google is hitting the road to meet with these cities and conducting detailed studies of factors that affect construction plans in each place, like topography, you know, hills, flood zones, housing density, and the condition of local infrastructure. There's no guarantee for any of those cities. Google said it genuinely would like to build in all of these cities, but that the complexities of deploying networks may not allow it. Please stop calling me on... Is it this that's doing it? Yes. Yeah. Please stop calling me.
That's your hangout. It's a Google. Your Google phone is thinking you're in a hangout.
I am in a hangout. It said it would likely like to build in all of these cities, but that the complexities of deploying networks may not allow it. During this process, we will work with each city to map out in detail what it would look like to build a new fiber optic network there, Google said. The most important part of this teamwork would be identifying what obstacles might pop up during network construction and then working together to find the smoothest path around those obstacles. Some might be easy, some might take more creative thinking or a few months to iron out. In some cases, there might be local complexities that we decide it's not the right time to build Google Fiber there. Of course, Google Fiber went live in Kansas City in late 2012, recently began serving customers in Provo, Utah. The company has begun construction in Austin, Texas, with a plan to hook up the first customers there later this year. Google said it will provide updates on which other cities will get Google Fiber before this year is over. The 34 cities being considered are Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tempe in Arizona, San Jose, Santa Clara, Sunnyvale, Mountain View, and Palo Alto in California, because, you know, they really need it, Atlanta, Avondale Estates, Brookhaven, College Park, Decatur, East Point, Hapeville, Sandy Springs, and Smyrna in Georgia, Nashville, Davison in Tennessee, Charlotte, Carbora, Cary, Chapel Hill, Durham, Garner, Morrisville, and Raleigh in North Carolina, Portland, Beaverton, Hillsboro, Gresham, Lake Oswego, and Tigard in Oregon, San Antonio in Texas, and Salt Lake City in Utah. Nowhere in the entire Northeast. Google Fiber in Kansas City offers gigabit internet for $70 a month or gigabit internet and TV for $120 a month. A 5 megabit per second service is offered at no monthly charge, but requires payment of a one-time $300 construction fee. That construction is waived for customers who buy the gigabit service. So would you get fiber access? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free 1-800-790-0415. Or, of course, give our own local Greenlight Networks a call and get on their list.
I like the how the map on Google's website says potential fiber cities.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We do have our own fiber construction company here in Rochester. It is Greenlight Networks. They are building neighborhoods out. Not my neighborhood yet, but they are building neighborhoods out. If you go to their website, you sign up, and that's how they decide the next network, the next neighborhood, by how much interest any particular neighborhood gives them. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Larry from Spencerport, New York. Welcome, Larry. What's up?
I have a question about dual band routers. If I have a device that's capable of 5 gigahertz. Now, does it automatically pick up the 5 gigahertz signal off my router, or I don't understand how they differentiate between the two bands.
Generally, in the router setup, you give the two bands different names.
Okay.
And oftentimes, you know, if your regular, the 2.4 band is the regular band, you know, if it's called wireless, then the other one is called wireless 5 gigahertz.
Okay.
5 gigahertz can go farther than 2.4, but it can't penetrate walls as well.
I see.
So there can be advantages both ways to it.
Okay. Well, I did set up a separate SSID on mine.
Yep.
And so I can select the two, but I was just curious if I didn't do that, what would happen?
Well, you have to select one or the other.
Okay, so.
So,
okay.
Yeah, that's how that works.
Although, could you give them both the same name? What would happen then?
Then you would get a confusion. You might get one, you might get the other. Yeah. Any device that can't do both might not be able to connect because it's
all,
trying to connect to the other one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, and one other question. Now, I have an iPhone 5, and I was able to see both SSIDs on mine. My wife has a 4S now, and she doesn't see it. Is there a difference between those two? I mean, if they change it where the 5 can use 5 gigahertz and the other one can't?
Yeah, it may be that the 4S didn't do 5 gigahertz.
Okay.
I'm trying to find the spec sheet on it now.
Yeah, each new generation of any phone has more capabilities than the previous generation, and certainly 5 gigahertz wasn't quite as ubiquitous when the 4 came out.
Yeah, the 4S is 2.4 gigahertz only.
Okay, that's thank you very much.
Yep, thanks.
All right, bye.
So some people, if you have a lot of devices, and that can be computers and tablets and phones and game consoles, you can put some of them on one and some of them on the other, so you're not saturating the bandwidth of one frequency band.
Right. But at some point, it all runs through the same router. So,
yeah.
That's you know, it's not going to be so great as you might think. I'm sorry, I can't read this.
Chihuahua.
No, that part I got. What's the name?
Howdy.
Howdy?
Yeah.
From Chihuahua, New York. Howdy, howdy. What's up?
Oh, hello. There's some miscommunication there. This is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
I guess. Yeah, sorry about that.
He probably said howdy. It's
you know,
Joe.
It now and again. I just said howdy as in hello.
Yep. Howdy.
Yeah. Anyhow, I had.
I thought it said howdy, and then I thought that can't be right. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
I had two SSIDs set up in my home, and it seemed to work just fine with my Nexus 7. It would hop from one to the other as necessary. It's just I eventually changed the name of the one of them because I wanted to know to which point I was connected. You know, your mileage may vary depending on your device.
Oh, that's good to know. Some of them will do that. Certainly, many devices nowadays just essentially, if they have the same name, it'll pick one.
And it had no problems associating. Unfortunately, the switch to which both access points are connected handled the same MAC address being on two different ports okay. Again,
well, and that's right, and that's the other issue. Will it do that? Will it do that well? Right.
Yeah.
And the 5 gigahertz band has more channels available, so you can have more devices on it without them overlapping, which works better for video streaming and gaming.
Right.
Oh, yes.
But doesn't penetrate walls as well. So.
Yeah, that slick login deal, that sounds an awful lot like what Steve Gibson has been working on. He called it SQRL. It stands for Secure Quick Reliable Login. Used to be, you know, Secure QR Code Login. But to go over that briefly, basically, when you log into a site, it will put up a QR code on the web page itself. You take your smartphone's camera, you aim in at that, and snap a picture of it, and it sends it along to the site you're trying to log in on, and through some miracle of mathematics, it figures out, oh, yes, that's who you say you are.
Right. SQRL is a similar idea. Quick Login also can use QR codes and about 50 other things as well. It's all the same idea, absolutely.
Trying to find a better thing than passwords. That's Steve Gibson has talked about that on a lot of the security shows, that passwords are sort of inherently bad these days because people use the same password on multiple services. They write them down. So if we could use something besides passwords, that could make things more secure. Then you see in the movies that you use a handprint so the bad guy cuts your hand off, or an iris scan.
I don't think anybody's going to...
Biometrics are kind of questionable because it's really tough to change them. Yes, they identify you uniquely, but as you're saying, cut off somebody's thumb to get in someplace,
Or worse, if you lose your thumb in an accident, you can't get into your sites anymore.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Yep, so you have to do more than one finger.
Right. And the same with eyes, right? So, yeah.
I just have to wonder how well something that relies on sound handles noise all that well, because, so you turn on your phone's microphone, you have all this music playing in the background, so how well can it distinguish the signal that's trying to come out of your computer?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, too. I'm like, is it set so it only picks up that certain decibel of where that sound is supposed to be?
Well, don't forget,
or can it confuse sounds of other sounds?
Right, but don't forget, this is not the human ear. This is not the human brain. It's not trying to pick content out of the noise. It's trying to pick frequencies. So it's just a frequency analyzer. If it hears the right frequencies in the right sequence, even amongst all the other frequencies and all of their sequences, it'll pick it up. So the question is not how well it can hear the sound, because it's going to hear it fine. The question is, how good is your microphone?
If it's barely audible, they probably put it way up in the high frequencies. So, first step is to put a high pass band filter on it.
Right, and basically you're now just looking at filtering out frequencies, which is ridiculously easy for computers to do.
I just think it's absolutely some black magic miracle that you can have these programs on your tablet or your phone that say, okay, listen to this music that's playing and somehow figure out exactly what song it is and who did it and all that.
Yep. Yeah, things like starts with an S.
Shazam.
Does that. But I don't think they do it in the phone. I think they send the file up to, the same thing that Siri and Google Now and all of those do. They send the actual file up to their servers, and they use, terabit speed servers to figure it all out.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Matter of fact, yeah, your Google Sound Search or your SoundHound won't work without an internet connection. I've tried. It says,
right,
your internet is not on.
Right. All right, and
well,
that's why.
Thank you very much. I thought I'd mention the squirrel thing.
I appreciate that, neat. Joe. Thanks, yeah. Yeah, squirrel's a very clever idea. Same thing as Slick Sound, Slick Login, I mean. And it's the whole concept of not passwords.
Yeah.
Or more than passwords is actually a very clever one.
I remember reading about one that would grab Facebook profile pictures, and one of them would be your friend, and you'd have to click on it. And so that's not something a bad guy could even do with the CAPTCHA or the math problems. The bad guys can do those, but he's not going to know who your friend is.
Yeah, but sometimes you're not either, because many people friend someone on Facebook that they really don't know.
And their profile pictures are often not their own face.
Right, so up comes somebody you've known for all your life, and their picture is a flower. Okay, I have no idea. And they just changed it this morning.
Yeah.
I have no idea who that is. Now I can't even get into my own website. Yeah, I wouldn't like that one myself. The thing with something like Slick Login is we really need something better than passwords. And what is that thing going to be? What's nice about something like Squirrel or Slick Login is it doesn't make a change to the form factor of the device you're logging in with. So they don't have to make some Like with fingerprint readers, I have one on this laptop, but I don't have to have that. You don't have to add hardware to a laptop to make it work with Slick Login or with Squirrel. SQRL, Squirrel, get it? You only have to, excuse me, you only have to have a phone, and so very many people have a cell phone nowadays. Same with Squirrel, you can do it with a QR code. With Slick Login, you do with any of those things, but they all work.
There was an episode of Futurama where Fry goes to the bank and they said, "We don't have your retina scan, your fingerprint, or your colonic map on file." Yeah. A colonic map?
Yeah. And you're not going to have that one on file, by the way.
How about I use my PIN? Oh my God, we haven't used a PIN in 1,000 years.
I got to dust off the card reader.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. It's 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Got a computer question? Call the boys now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free 800-790-0415. Online at soundbites.org. Soundbites continues next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before...
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. We talked earlier about mapping the world with Google, and Google has built a prototype Android smartphone that can learn and map the world around it. The device comes from a new initiative called Project Tango, and it's ready to get the phone into developers' hands to see what the technology is capable of. Google, that's one of my favorite things about Google. Let's just build this and shoot it out there and see what happens. Google says that the phone will learn the dimensions of rooms and spaces just by being moved around inside them. Walking around your living room, for example, would help the phone learn the shape of your home. The hope is that by creating a robust map of the world, Google's phone could eventually give precise directions to any given point that needs to be reached. It's an ambitious product, but that should, project, but that should be no surprise given who it's coming from. Tango comes out of the Advanced Technology and Projects Group, one of the few places pieces of Motorola that Google has opted to hang on to rather than sell. The goal of Project Tango is to give mobile devices a human-scale understanding of space and motion, says Johnny Lee, leader of Project Tango. Google has 200 devices that it's preparing to give out to developers who want to build mapping tools, games, and new algorithms that take advantage of the phone's sensors, and it's expected to send them all out by March 14th. The Tango devices work by using a motion tracking camera and a depth sensor built into their backsides. While being moved around, the sensors will detect their orientation, what's in front of them, use those data to build out a 3D map of their surroundings. While the basic goal is to create detailed indoor maps, Google's distribution of developer devices speaks to the other possibilities it sees coming out of these types of data. It suggests that Tango could be used to create more realistic augmented reality games or to assist the visually impaired when they're navigating an unfamiliar environment. Google stresses that the technology is still in its early stages, but it still sees it as on the way to reaching millions of people down the road. And now the Advanced Technology and Projects Group will have plenty of time and resources to make that happen. Alongside the announcement of Tango, Android chief Sundar Pichai extended a welcome to the team, suggesting that they have now fully fallen under Google. The group is also responsible for Project Aura, which hopes to build modular smartphones. That's a very cool one, by the way. If the smartphones are modular, you can put whatever you want in them. Project Tango appears to be a natural fit for Lee's leadership. Lee's name may be familiar from his work creating virtual reality tools out of a Wii remote while at Carnegie Mellon. I actually met him when he came to RIT to talk about doing that. Nice guy. And later for helping Microsoft develop the Kinect. He joined Google in 2011, and clearly he's still been working on an equally ambitious motion tracking project since then. Google says it did not create Tango on its own, however, but with assistance from various universities and research institutions as well. The project has been in the works at the Advanced Technology Group for the past year. So what do you think of Tango? give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415, just like John did from Rochester, New York. Welcome, John. What's up?
Hi, Nick. Good afternoon. How are you?
Peachy, thanks. You?
Good to hear. Good to hear. Not too bad. Not too bad. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I've got a really old-school question. I have a ThinkPad T42,
wow,
the original 40-gig hard drive, and I have an 80-gig that I want to, for whatever reason, well, I would like to maintain an XP operating system, and if there's a clone application in order to do that. And if it's really too much trouble, I probably won't do that because I fundamentally run Linux all the way through. But if I was going to transfer the XP, plus there's an IBM service package on a rear-end partition, on the final partition, I wouldn't mind picking up both of those if it's not too much trouble.
Well, Norton Ghost is the granddaddy,
uh-huh,
but that's commercial and expensive.
Right. No, that's not going to be – I'm not going to do that.
Clonezilla might do what you want. I would
okay.
do some decent research into that before I got much farther.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and make sure it does.
So what I would be doing is flashing or copying the OS image onto an external hard drive, like a free agent, and then having to boot in and then transfer the files. Like I said, Clonezilla and probably follow the directions. And
yeah,
I may or may not do that if it's if it's a lot of trouble and work, it may not be worth the.
Yeah, particularly if you're mostly using Linux these days anyway.
Yeah. Okay, thank
and
you
let's
very
face
much,
it, but before you hang up, you
sure.
really need to note that using XP is going to become more and more dangerous as exploits that are in there are not going to be patched.
Okay.
So if you
got
go
it.
On the internet with an XP machine, it is very it becomes increasingly more likely as time goes by that you will be owned.
Okay. Here's the second question. I have Windows 7, which I picked up, and I have it on a disk, which doesn't do me much good. But I can, and I don't really think that like the ThinkPad T42 probably will handle it, even with a RAM upgrade. You know, I probably was going to upgrade at least to 1 gig, maybe 2 gig of RAM.
Well, you want a minimum of 2 gig for Windows 7. 4 is better.
Gotcha. Okay, very good then. Thank you very much, Nick.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That good information is good. Thank you,
yep.
sir.
Thanks.
Bye now.
Bye.
Well, unfortunately or unfortunately maybe, Microsoft did extend XP again till July of next year. They're going to keep putting out patches.
They can't get rid of it. It
yeah.
will not die.
Too many people are still using it. Too many corporations are still
That's
using it.
That's the big thing. They don't care about
yeah.
people, but they do care about corporations. Well, corporations are people. We have to remember we live in America.
We have two XPs in this studio.
Yep.
We have one here and one over there.
And that's mostly what it is. It's computers that are working fine. They're doing their job. And why spend money on replacing them?
The reality is you set something up, you don't want to screw around with it anymore. That's one of the reasons I try to set up most of my machines with Linux, because I can upgrade them. And if I keep using stuff that's in the repositories, unless the last person who's been maintaining that package dies, those packages will be maintained and keep on going. So that's the nice thing about Linux. But it's not true of any other operating system. If you've still got an old G5 Mac, you're not getting a lot of support out of Apple anymore.
Yep.
If you've got an XP machine, you're not getting a lot of support out of Microsoft. You aren't getting a lot of support for old versions of Linux, but it's generally easier to upgrade them because it's all free and all you have to do is say yes when it comes up and says, do you want to upgrade? But yeah, Microsoft is deeply invested in Windows 8 and wants you to move to it because they don't make any money if you stay on XP.
They're begging you to move to Windows 8. They're begging you. They're on their knees.
Yeah. They don't make any money if you stick with Windows XP.
Did Microsoft renege on their extension of support? Because on Microsoft's own website, they're saying it ends in April.
That's regular support. Extended support I think it continues longer, but I don't think regular support does.
I'm going to have to find their deeper life cycle chart.
Yeah, the life cycle chart will tell you that. That's the other, you know, Microsoft is a little scared. They've long been scared of Apple a little bit. Apple is a higher end niche than they are, and so that doesn't mean quite as much to them. But they're very scared of Linux. They're very scared of the Chromebook. You can tell how scared they are because they keep putting out ads against it. I keep seeing those ads, and I keep thinking, oh, all that hate for just a little operating system. And part of it is because you don't ever worry about updating. You go into help, and if there's an update, it does it automatically in the background, and then it tells you you need to reboot, and you're done. It's finished. And reboot takes 8 seconds, by the way, from a cold boot. So that's not so hard to do, and that scares Microsoft. It does. I get it. It doesn't have the same kind of upgrade cycle that so many other things have. We'll see as time goes on how that plays out. But
wishy-washy. Support does end this April for XP.
Right.
They'll continue to issue virus warnings until July 2015.
Well, what's the point of that?
Yeah.
So they're going to issue warnings, but they're not going to
do anything about it. An entire year, you will get a message that says, hey, guess what? You're not protected.
Yeah.
Hey, there's a virus and it could affect your computer. We could help you, but we don't have that support anymore.
Won't.
Please switch to Windows 7, or better yet, Windows 8, please.
Windows 8 is
Windows
what
9,
they want you
yeah.
to send to, or 9 by the time that's out. So, but that's the point. They don't want you to stay on Windows XP. They just don't want it.
So they are going to update their anti-malware signatures. So Microsoft Security Essentials and Windows Defender will be the only thing updated. For XP.
Right.
But no security patches to the OS itself.
Right.
Also Office 2003, if you're still using that.
Yeah, that's pretty much done. Well, you you still have to buy Office. But you can use Office Online, you can use iCloud Online.
Well, yeah, you don't, I had this conversation with my sister this week. You don't have to pay for Microsoft Office. You can use many of the free alternatives.
LibreOffice, OpenOffice,
yep.
Zoho Writer, any of the online
yeah.
systems like Google Drive or iCloud.
Yep.
I actually tried it on my Chromebook. I can do all three of them. Google Drive, of course. iCloud and Office Live or Office 365, whatever they're calling it today. So all of those things work, you know, even on my Chromebook. So because they're just web apps.
Yep.
You know, any system you have, you can use them on my Linux box because they're just web apps. As long as you have a browser that will do HTML5, you're good to go. So, you know, you can use any or all of those without issue. The one thing I truly love about Windows Office that I cannot get anywhere else in a quite equivalent package is OneNote. I do love the things you can do with OneNote. But the rest of it, I don't care. I can do word processing anywhere, spreadsheets anywhere. With all that stuff anywhere.
Unless you're a student at Brockport and your professor mandates you use Windows Word because all they have is Microsoft Word. So you have to use Microsoft Word.
Well, almost every one of the free alternatives will save in a doc file. So Word will open it and not know any better.
Right. I was in a meeting yesterday with a couple of people and I was taking notes on my Chromebook. So I was doing it in Drive. And then at the end, I said, let me email it to all of you as an attachment. It says, great, what kind of attachment? HTML5, OpenOffice, DocX. Well, I picked DocX, hit send, and they all got it as an attachment
in
Word
that,
format.
Well, I know that, and you know that, but a lot of other people don't know that.
Yep.
Right, right,
like
right.
A lot of other people don't know that.
They panic.
Right, right.
They go, oh my God, it's not Word, it's not going to be compatible, everybody panic.
Right. And in the only thing that isn't 100% compatible are the fonts. You can use a lot more fonts in some alternatives than come with Windows in Word. But as long as you use the same fonts you were using in Windows, the fonts everybody has, Arial, Times New Roman, whatever those are.
Comic Sans.
Comic Sans. as long as you use those fonts, except Comic Sans, you won't. Nobody will even know. For years, I had a Linux desktop at work, and I would share documents with people who only had Windows. They had no idea that I wasn't using Word or Excel or PowerPoint or any of those things, because you could send it to them in exactly that way. We are really getting to the point, and this is the problem Microsoft has, we're getting to the point where an Office suite is a commodity.
Yep.
Everybody's got one. Many of them are free. Microsoft still makes a metric bucket load of cash off of Office. But that revenue stream is going to go away as soon as more people realize they don't need Office to do word processing or spreadsheets.
Yep. And Microsoft has shifted a little bit by offering their subscription service now. $100 a year for 5 computers is pretty cheap.
It's a pretty decent amount of money.
But it's $100 every year. You stop paying, it stops working.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
And one of the really nice things I do like about Google is Google Takeout, which used to be called the Data Liberation Front. And what it lets you do is download anything you've written in Google's Drive. Anything you have in Google's Drive, whether it's your documents, your spreadsheets, pictures, your posts on Google Plus, whatever it is you want, you can download all of it to your machine because they think your data are your data, and they don't have to worry about anything else. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Sound Bites right here on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you in a couple.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are the Windy Sound Bites. Windy has storm. Yeah, never mind. iPhone owners say, this is my favorite story this week. iPhone owners say Siri couldn't answer questions like when is St. Patrick's Day, but a judge ruled this was not enough to grind a lawsuit against Apple. Customers who sued Apple over disappointing performance of their iPhone's personal assistant, Siri, are out of luck after a federal judge concluded they didn't show fraud or breach of warranty. In a decision issued Friday in Oakland, U.S. District Judge Claudia Wilkin said Apple's marketing descriptions of Siri as the coolest feature, a breakthrough, and an intelligent personal assistant were just puffery and could not be grounds for a lawsuit. The ruling is likely the end of the road for phone owners who claimed that they had shelled out extra money to obtain the iPhone 4S after seeing commercials like Siri Snow Today that showed the Apple gadget consistently answering questions about weather, music, and more. In reality, Siri did not work out that way. The customers in the lawsuit said Siri could not answer questions like, how do you play a B minor chord, or when is St. Patrick's Day, and that the device instead paused before answering, I don't understand. According to Judge Wilkin, the customers could not point to an Apple statement that had been specific enough for the company to be able to respond to a fraud claim. She refused to accept that Siri's performance in the ads meant Apple had to defend a claim over consistent performance. The judge's reference to mere puffery has been used by courts for over a century to reject false advertising and breach of contract suits. The judge concluded the ruling by saying that the customers could not amend their complaint for a fourth time, meaning their only option is to appeal to a higher court. So, honestly, did you ever believe any Siri ad ever?
Or any ad in general.
Any ad.
It doesn't work as well as it does on TV.
Period.
Wow, right. That's surprising.
Give us a call, 585-966-CHAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
Okay, has it gotten to this point that we're suing Apple over Siri?
Yep.
Why?
Yes.
Well,
people have that kind of money.
It was probably some lawyer who decided there was a class there that he could make some money on, and maybe it's a nuisance suit, and Apple will pay a few hundred million dollars just to get it out of the way.
And that's exactly the reason. It's all about the money. If this company was, if Siri was owned by Fred's Podunk Computer Company, nobody would sue them because there's no money there. This is Apple Computer. They have $100 gazillion just sitting in Scrooge McDuck's bank vault. So, and they swim in it all day. This is not a real lawsuit. These people are probably not actually idiots. They're just greedy morons. I get it. I would love to be able to say to my phone, how do I play a B minor chord? And in fact, maybe I could. I haven't tried it, but maybe on Google Now.
It may work now because it's, 4 years later?
Right, yeah. Right. And the same with Siri. I was just about to say, and the same with Siri. It's 4 years later, and the changes are such that you might say, how do I play a B minor chord? And both of them might bring up a web page with a picture of the fingering for a B minor chord. But that's not the same thing as... this is real life. This is not her.
Apparently.
The Joaquin Phoenix movie.
Right. Apparently Siri, who is known to make jokes about computer-driven movies or movies with computer characters, made some snide remark about her. Was it Scarlett Johansson who plays her got offended?
Well, that's investing in your character a little a little more than you should, but and that's part of that, of course, is because Apple tends to A, overhype everything. I don't think they've ever put out anything that wasn't an amazing breakthrough, the greatest thing since laser sliced bread, the niftiest, most up to wonder thing you've ever seen. So that's part of it, but the other part of it is that Siri is anthropomorphized, and consequently, you tend to give her more credit.
Yeah,
I just called her.
Yeah,
than a computer program deserves.
Yeah, don't anthropomorphize computers. They hate that. Except on Big Bang Theory, when Raj tracked down the voice of Siri, and it was a person.
Yeah, it is.
And she talks like that in real life.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, people are like, talk to Siri like Siri is an actual person, and then they get angry when they don't get the answer that they want, or they don't get an answer, period.
Yep, which is why I like Google Now, because it doesn't pretend to be a human being. You know, it doesn't pretend to be an actual...
Well, their code name was Majel, right? After the computer in Star Trek.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Majel Roddenberry, who played the computer in Star Trek.
Right, Majel Barrett Roddenberry, right. But the basic point is, it's just a computer program, and it only does things computers do. Now, Ray Kurzweil has said that 20 years from now, her could be a reality. If we have those artificial intelligence breakthroughs that he's been trying to do for the past 30 years.
And that's what science fiction shows have done for the past 50 years, too.
Right.
You talk to the computer and it answers the computer.
Right. And the Big Bang Theory, by the way, the woman who played the voice of Siri was not actually
the voice of Siri.
The voice of Siri.
But the voice of Siri has pretty much been found.
Susan
Bennett of Atlanta.
Right.
She apparently recorded a bunch of voices several years before Apple used Siri for a company called Nuance, which is known for their speech recognition. They make the Dragon software.
Right. They bring actors into the studio. This is a gig I wish I would have had. They bring actors into the studio to read phonemes. Ah, oo, t, th, And then they put them together into words. And it used to be they were pretty monotonous. We've all heard this computer voice. And that's the original day. Now you would say, we've all heard this computer voice. It sounds so natural, but it's exactly the same technology. It's phonemes stuck together. And she did that. She sat in a room and recorded all those things. It's just like those poor people, God love them, who sit in a room and record turn, left, right, now, 100 feet, 200 feet. 300 feet. By the end of the day, you're just hoping to slit your own throat with your water bottle, because it's the most boring thing.
If you're the Darth Vader, so there's a lot of parody videos of celebrities, because a lot of celebrities do voices.
Yeah.
So you can download a real celebrity voice for your GPS, and so there was a Darth Vader parody bit about
funny.
The roundabout. Yeah.
You're right. Right. And for a while, for a very short while, the lady who does the directions for Google's Navigate would say, your destination is on the right. My destination?
Yeah.
I don't know what a destination even is. But clearly that was just a phoneme tweak that needed to be made. Replace the O phoneme with the I phoneme, destination.
James Earl Jones was on The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, they're pranking Carrie Fisher's ring her doorbell and run away. Right. And it's really Carrie Fisher.
I'm just going to briefly interrupt this conversation. Yeah. We have a call from Aranda Coit on the line, and I want to get her in the next 2 minutes before we get a singer.
Yeah. Hi there. Who's this?
Nick, it's Ida.
Hi, Ida. How are you?
I'm fine. I had to call because you first got me when you said, we're in America, corporations are people, which is my favorite thing to say.
Yep.
But I thought the only other, how wonderful it is to hear on the airwaves someone who actually knows and can put in a sentence the word phoneme.
Yeah, we may have to define that for some of our listeners.
Nonsense. Our listeners are smart. All of them are on the level of Ida, who, by the way, I will admit publicly, I'm madly in love with and have been for decades. Is life good for you, Ida?
So I don't have a computer question, but I always appreciate your program. I appreciate your intellect and your humor.
Well, thank you, honey.
And I do think you should have gotten that gig because you'd be a great voice to encounter on some computerized whatever.
Thank you. Yeah, but with my luck, it'd be like, what's wrong with you? You should have turned left.
It's the plug in the outlet. Yeah.
Did you turn it on?
Yeah, right. That's it. Automated tech support. Did you reboot?
Anyway, so hello to all of you, and thank you. I'll let you go to someone with a real question.
Thanks, Ida.
All right.
Apparently, you actually can get Darth Vader for your TomTom.
Nice.
So
I had a TomTom.
So the YouTube video was outtakes of the Darth Vader recording.
But yeah, the celebrity voice thing is huge. I don't know if there's an option for that for Siri or for Google Now, but it's the sort of thing that I would consider actually paying a couple of bucks for to get Darth Vader or Scarlett Johansson, definitely, or Ida. Ida could do it for me. All right, we're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to apologize to those to whom we did not get call earlier and more often this week. Don't go anywhere because George is coming in to play the best German music you will hear all week long. Michael, unfortunately, is stuck here with him. I mean, Michael is delighted to be spending the next few hours with George here in the studio. We're getting out of here as quickly as possible. We'll see you next week. This has been the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.